say what? A whole lot of superstars on this stage here tonight. But I want y'all to know one thing. This is my house. And when I say whose house, y'all know what time it is. Whose house?
All right. Welcome to the State of Games. I'm Dice Hayton.
I'm Get Louder.
I'm Puppy Shogun.
And I'm Filled Fangirl.
And we are a podcast all about anything and everything related to board and card games. So welcome to episode 128, or as we like to call it, the one about house rules. So this is a topic that's come up from time to time as we've talked about games over the years, but we've never really taken the chance to talk about the prevalence of house rules or some of our personal favorites. We thought that could be kind of fun. Besides, after
yeah, because you play a lot of games that are really bad that need them.
Like what, TC?
I don't know. I'm not even going to give examples until we get to it.
Okay, that's fine. Well, we'll get more into that during the meat of the podcast. But for now, what's everyone been up to since we last got together? Daryl, why don't you tell us where you've been and what you've been doing?
Yes, because my life is so exciting.
It is.
It is.
But this time, it is. So last week, I went to Texas. I went to Houston to visit a family. Leslie's aunt turned 80, so it was a big surprise birthday party. And, you know, fun with the in-laws. But after 2 days, we were like, you know what? Let's go to Galveston, Texas. So we went down south to Galveston, Texas, and had 3 days down at the beach, more or less, on Galveston Island, which was just amazing, both historically, entertainment-wise. Food is so good there, if you like seafood and barbecue. And it was just, it was great. One of the highlights of our entire trip was we actually got to meet up with Scott King and Lisa to play some board games at the hotel.
Cool.
Yeah.
So they brought games because we didn't take any with us short of a couple two players. And they brought up Tavarua, New York Slice, one of the new Dungeons & Dragons games, which I don't remember what it was called. It was like After the Depths or something.
It was anyway. Good Ghosts.
Yes. it was Scott, Lisa, Leslie, myself, and my son Ethan. We played New York Slice, which is a really cool set collection game from Bezier Games where you're collecting slices of pizza and you're trying to get the majority of different types of pizzas to score that number of points. But you can also eat a slice when you claim it to get the points equal to the pepperoni that are on the slice. Mm. But you have to be careful because if you get anchovies, it's negative points.
Oh, that's BS.
Which, that's what I said. But
so
they have,
true.
But the cool thing is, so there's the pizza that's 11 slices, which it's like, who cuts pizza in 11 slices? yeah. So when you're the active player, however many players are playing, so say if it was the four of us, I have to split the 11 sliced pizza into four groups without rearranging the slices, just pulling it apart. And then whoever's to my left, so say it's Jess would choose which group of pizza she's taking first, then Chris, then TC, then I would get whatever's left. And to sweeten the deal, whichever one I want or by itself, there's a combo card that goes on a stack of pizza, and that gives that player a different way to score, or it gives them an alternate power. So one is like anchovies are plus 1 point instead of minus 1 point, but it's just for that player. So those are constantly being introduced to the game. There's a bunch. So like, you don't get the same ones every single time you play the game. But that was really cool. And Ethan really loved it. Leslie really loved it. And I played it before. It's got really cool. I mean, the theme went all out on that. The game box opens up like a pizza box, but it's still the 2 mil card, like board stock that you're used to on a game board. The score pad looks like a diner order taking notepad. So it's just like those little touches that's like, this is really cool. Like they really went out on this, and I applaud them for not making any part of it werewolf. but it was really good, and I'm going to be acquiring that one for sure. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and it's really pretty. It for pizza. And then Tavarua, we've talked to Tavarua a bunch, but we played with Ethan. And I can say that a 7-year-old can play Tavarua.
Well, there you go.
But.
But.
Quadruple the game time.
Now, the question part, the important part is, did you have to house rule anything for Ethan?
Not really. It was a lot of re-explaining how things worked for him.
Right.
But about halfway into the game, so about an hour in, he kind of got it and everything was fine. The house rule for Tavarua was that he won because he's so good and we were just determining second and third place people.
Right, gotcha.
And typically, Chris knows, I never throw a game for Ethan. I never, you know... make myself play worse or anything like that. Like, I kind of make him like learn that if you want to win the game, you win by actually winning. That's the satisfaction of it. So we don't pull punches with him, and he doesn't cheat or anything like that. He'll try to do stuff every now and then, but that's just a kid. But it's not like cheating. It's just, well, I want to jump on the six wave because it's right there. Well, you can't. Or I'm sorry, a three wave while it's on the six. And it's like, no, you can't. You gotta. That's not how. Anyway. So there's that. And then tonight, years ago, Ethan destroyed my copy of Maya, which is a game that TC and I talked about because I bought it at Origins 4 or 5 years ago.
5 years ago.
Yeah. So it was a gem that TC and I found. I think he bought a copy too, but I bought a copy. Ethan destroyed it, and I've not been able to find it because I believe the company has folded. The game's out of print. And thankfully, I was actually able to locate a brand new copy somewhere, actually in Germany. And I paid and had it shipped out and surprised Leslie with it. And so we played that for the first time since getting it back in, which was really exciting. And that's just a really fun game. And I feel really weird talking about it again because I've talked about it so much in the past. But, I mean, it has been a couple of years. It's very puzzly. We only play it two-player. We've tried three- and four-player. Excuse me, but just not as much fun. The two players, definitely where the satisfaction is. It's trying to build as many Mayan temples all the same color and then scoring points. We did find out tonight that in all the years and all the times we've played it in the past, we've been doing the end game scoring totally wrong.
Oh, no.
So, but yeah, so it's still very enjoyable.
Hopefully not as bad as the Princes of Florence.
No. No, this one has just been robbing points from us. We would just go, oh, okay, you know, you have the priest, that's a point. You have majority here, that's a point. Well, what we've been neglecting is if you have the priest on the top, it's 1 point. But if you have whoever has the majority of stairs on the pyramid, they also get a point. So you could potentially get 2 points from every pyramid, or I get 1 point and Leslie gets a point, so therefore it negates. And it's been a weird thing, but it makes the end game scoring swing and makes it far more thinky. So awesome. It was for the better.
Well, good. I'm glad you finally figured out how to really play the game. Yeah. It took 5 years. So.
Yeah, I know. Hey, I think it took, 6 years to get Puerto Rico, right? So
well, there you go. All right, TC, what have you been up to?
Well, last weekend was my sister's wedding. So I went out, and I had to dress up, and I had to be in the wedding and escort my mom down. So that was fun. So I did the music, and their speaker ran out of batteries, like, as they were leaving.
Oh,
so it was kind of like I'm pressing the button going, what's going on? I just saw the button over there, fine. But, yeah. So it was weird. I was kind of – I was DJing with YouTube videos. But I guess that works, right?
Sure.
It was an awesome wedding. Everybody dressed up it was like kind of open season for pop culture. So you could dress up as like Doctor Who people, as like Lord of the Rings. I mean, there wasn't any Doctor Who. I was kind of disappointed. But there was Transformers outfits and ties and Pokemon and Lord of the Rings, and yeah, it was like my cousins dressed up in these awesome, like, I think they all look like they're, it was like four Legolases. It just looked like four Legolases. Which is fine. But we had a Hobbit, it was awesome, yeah. So that was really cool. During that, though, I taught a bunch of drunk people how to play Anomia.
That's always fun.
Well, because I brought, like, a bat, like, I always try to do that whole thing where I'm like, well, what do I expect people to want to actually play at a wedding? So I'm like, party games, maybe something else. So, like, I just brought Code Names and, like, No Thanks and Coup and all those games. So I just tried out. And I thought Anomia would be perfect when everybody's kind of, like, it was, like, 9 o'clock at night. Everyone's kind of drunk, kind of whatever. And, yeah, it was awesome. It's good. It's good to see a game that's, like, I really enjoy. But I didn't even play. I just watched. I just taught it and let people play, and even super drunk they were good at it. Yeah. It was awesome.
So I'll tell you, really... sometimes like playing Anomia drunk is actually preferable to overthinking it when you're sober.
I think it is, actually, because I think the people who were drunk were doing better than the people who were slightly more sober. But I don't know, Anomia, you just yell out cards that are in front of other people. They just have like the word vegetable on it, and you're just yelling out like, oh, I gotta yell out vegetable before they yell out a donut flavor in front of me, right? If I'm not gonna get into it more than that. It sounds like I introduced it as the dumbest game you'll ever play, and they just loved it. So I think people pick up a copy of that. So that was good. So I got to play one game at a wedding, and that was great. And all my family is awesome, apparently. I forgot that my family was so cool.
And you said they did their vows in Klingon. They finished their vows in Klingon, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. She finished her vows in Klingon. Although, I was watching a video on pronunciation of fantasy languages, and I think she may have mispronounced some of them.
The wedding's annulled.
The mach. She couldn't get that very nicely. So.
It's no longer recognized by the Klingon High Council, then.
Yeah, I she would definitely have an accent that would be weird. I think they would have. So, no, but that was awesome too. So yeah, good call. When I talked to my cousins and stuff, we ate Easter dinner then the next day for lunch, and had a little bar called the Gingerbread Man in our area, and it was super awesome. The other thing I did was this last weekend I got together with Luke, which I don't see very often, but now I have started seeing a little more. And we played, or I actually bought Patchwork, because I never bought Patchwork. And we had played it before, and he was asking about it. And I'm like, man, I should just buy this. So we bought it, and we started playing Patchwork, but we ended up playing Xenon Profiteer a lot. So instead, we bought Patchwork, and then I just ended. I mean, I guess we played 3 games of Patchwork, but we played like 2 or 3 games of Xenon Profiteer too. And it was good to break out Xenon Profiteer again. Man, 2-player games. Patchwork is all about building quilts, and Xenon Profiteer is all about distilling Xenon, cryogenically distilling Xenon from the air we breathe. And both are reality. Yeah, both are reality. Yeah. But also one is super scientific and kind of esoteric. And the other one is just extremely family friendly, but not friendly to anybody who plays games. I don't know who wants to build a quilt. I really don't.
Hey, now, there are a lot of passionate quilters out there, and we actually have a game coming from Dice Hate Me Games before too long called Match Quilt, which is all about making a quilt as well. And every time it's on the table, every time somebody sees that on the table and they're a quilter, they go nuts, or they go, oh my gosh, my mother quilts, or my aunt, or my sister, or my brother, or whoever. They've got, like, it's a passionate community, man.
I love the fact that the guy who made a game about brewing coffee or filtering Xenon is like, who wants to play a game about making quilts?
Yeah, who wants to play a game about making quilts when you can play Xenon Profiteer? Come on.
That's an excellent point, Daryl.
It is an excellent point. Thank you. But I will say, Luke, he was like, he contacted me afterwards. And he was like, dude, I really want to play Xenon again. It's like, that was really good. And that's over Patchwork. And I'm like, man, yeah. And get at least one person to say they like Xenon Profiteer better than Patchwork. That's amazing.
Well, I will tell you right now that I would rather play Xenon than Patchwork, and they're both excellent. So,
sweet. You see, you guys are great. All right. Over to Jessica.
Yeah, Jessica, take it off.
All right. So I've been gone for a while. I was not present on the last episode, but I know you guys handle it well.
That's why it was so long.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
No, Jessica trying to hurry you along.
Yeah.
But I went to California to visit my home state. It had actually been like over 8 years since I'd been back. I can't believe that. It had been 8 years since I'd seen my father. So I thought it was about time that I went back and visited. And so I saw my dad, and I saw my sister, and I saw my best friend I hadn't seen in a while and hung out with her and her family. But another thing that was cool was that I went and visited my other podcast family, the Our Turn podcast. They're actually based in Sacramento. And so that's where I was staying. I was staying with my friend in Sacramento. And so we met up in person and we recorded a live podcast episode together and then played games afterwards. So that was really cool to finally actually meet the people that I do the podcast with because I hadn't met them yet. And then while I was there, I visited a friend and realized that my 20-year high school reunion is next year. I can't believe it's been that long. And so that's why I'm in severe pain today because I started working out today so that I can be in shape for my reunion next year.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it hurts to walk downstairs. Like, I can't even walk downstairs, let alone go up them. It's, like,
Jessica,
so bad.
I got a little secret to share with you. The picture you posted the other day of you with your glasses and everything, you're gonna look better than that when you go to your high school reunion, so don't worry about
that. Yeah, so no matter what, it's an improvement, so exactly. That's good. Yeah, you don't have to worry about it. I don't plan on going to any high school reunion ever.
But what's awesome is that actually my best friends were like, how do you look so young? Because black don't crack. And I look so much younger than everybody that I went to high school with, so at least I'll look younger than everybody.
Yeah, there you go, exactly.
But then immediately after the trip to California, I flew to New Hampshire to go to the Granite Game Summit, which is the game convention that Kimberly Revia and some other people have started up there in the northeast, because they don't have too much gaming up in that area. And it was really cool because a bunch of people I met at, like, Origins and Gen Con last year, because they live a little bit more north, ended up going to that convention, so I got to meet up with them a lot, and we just gamed a lot for like 3 full days. It was April 7th through the 9th. And 2 games I played there were really awesome. One was I finally got in my first play of Thebes, which is the archaeological game. We're playing archaeologists and trying to gain necessary knowledge in order to go to these exposition sites and dig for artifacts. And that, Chris, you're right. There's something about digging into bags. That's just so much fun in games.
And people love it, man.
And this one's fun because it's very similar to New Bedford, where you dig in the bag and you're trying to find artifacts. And the more knowledge you have, then the more you can dig, and the more discs you can pull out, which may have artifacts or may just be dirt in the sand. But then all of the dirt goes back in, so now there's a bigger ratio of dirt to artifacts if artifacts were removed. So at the end of the game, it's just like a mad grab. You're like hoping that you'll grab some artifacts to gain some points at the end of the game. So that was just so much fun. And I didn't actually think I'd like that game so much, but it was like the highlight of the convention for me, realizing how awesome that game is. And Reeves got cool. Taught that game.
Yeah.
Thebes is classic.
Yeah. And then another game I played was Sagrada. This is the game designed by Andrew Adamescu and Daryl Andrews from Floodgate Games. I guess it had just gotten released to Kickstarter backers. And this is the game where you're basically building the stained glass windows of the large Catholic church in Barcelona, the Sagrada Familia. And it's a dice drafting game. And some people have been comparing it to Role Player, where you're drafting dice and placing them on your window pattern card, trying to, like, the window pattern cards will have specific requirements. Like, it'll have a space that says you have to place a die with a value of 2 here, and then in another place, like, a die with a value of 5 or something. And when you're drafting them, once you place your first die, you have to place your continuing dice as you go in subsequent rounds adjacent or directly diagonal to that, because you're building stained glass, so you kind of start from one point and spread out from there. But what's interesting is that you cannot place the same color adjacent to each other orthogonally, or the same number orthogonally, because the number is supposed to indicate the shade of that color die. So the lower the die value, like, the lighter the shade, and then if it's a 6, then that's like the darkest shade of that specific color. And then there are these objective cards that are laid out for the game. There are different ones, and I guess they get shuffled and put out for different games, and those will indicate how you score depending on how you oriented your dice on your little pattern card. So abstracty, but it's like kind of clever how you have to draft the dice. There are these little tokens you get that you can trade in to do these other special abilities if for some reason you want to draft the regular dice there and stuff. So it was very like kind of a zen but fun game, and you you draft the dice in snake order, so that can affect your decisions and stuff. It's very cool, and compared to role player, I preferred this one because I'm not a big fantasy person, and role player is all fantasy themed. But Sagrada was fun, and it was played. It was, to me, Sagrada at this convention was like Terraforming Mars at that board gaming thing last year. I just saw it everywhere, and it was constantly getting played.
Yeah, Sagrada has been just all over the place since its release, and I mean it's been so much so that it's been up in the top 10 of the hotness on BGG for quite a while.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, we've talked about Sagrada in the past. I actually Daryl had pitched Sagrada to me a couple of Gen Cons ago, and I thought it was a really great design. We just, you know, couldn't take it, but I'm glad that Ben at Floodgate got a chance to do it. Saw it, of course, demo wise and art wise at Gen Con last time. So it's a really pretty game. You know, pretty easy to get into, but definitely some thinky parts for the abstractness.
Yeah, I haven't played role player, and now I'm like, that's weird that it's like very similar to role player.
Yeah, I haven't played it either. I've heard good things about role player, but I had no idea it would be similar to Sagrada.
Yeah, role player is a little bit, has more like aspects to it. Like with role player, you can like move your dice because like different rows of the dice have like different abilities and stuff. So there's a lot more like changing of the dice and stuff in that game. And Sagrada, I pretty much, once you place the dice, just left there. So it's just
yeah.
a little, the, it just flows better for me. And then there are like all these other cards that you draft too in role player that have different abilities, and it's a little bit of engine building kind of there. And there can be some set collection with that stuff too, but none of that stuff is in Sagrada. Sagrada's okay. Like, just more simplified, but
yeah, I thought it was so streamlined. It felt like what was that Rolling Japan, or even like Quicks, even like it was just very streamlined in that sense.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
Well, let me talk about what I've been up to. So
no.
Okay, let's move on to the podcast. So I've been playing a lot of games, actually. I've introduced Lillian to a lot of kind of, not necessarily, well, some two-player games, but some other games that she hasn't been experienced with. She hasn't had any experience with Fleet, so I taught her Wharfside and got a chance to give TC crabs, so that's always fun. yeah, everybody's always tweeting at me that they're giving me crabs, and I was like, hey, you know what, I'm going to spread it around a little bit this time. So yeah, so Fleet, Wharfside's a lot of fun. We've also got together, Dan and I got together with Chris Mosley and played more Gloomhaven, so our characters are leveling up. I'm like level 3 scoundrel now. I'm stealing everybody's gold. It's awesome. Just a quick plug that we just released the latest Geek All-Stars, which has an interview with Isaac Childress, who is the mastermind behind Gloomhaven, the you know, publisher, designer, just everything. And we talk about his madness and how much it went into production of Gloomhaven, so check that out on the latest Geek All-Stars. Other than that, a few little things here and there. Went to Adam O'Brien's house, played Diamonds for the first time in about a year, and of course Diamonds is just a great game as far as trick taking. It's just so good. If you haven't played Diamonds, seek out a copy, get somebody to borrow it, buy it, whatever you need to do, but Diamonds is one of the best modern trick taking classics in my opinion. We went to this weekend to my mom's for a late Easter because we didn't get a chance to get away last weekend. But we went to my mom's, so we got a chance to play a few different things. And one of the highlights of this weekend was a game that actually was mentioned by Pub Sugar last episode. And that is Gum Gum Machine, or Goom Goom Machine, or however you want to say it. But Gum Gum Machine was described last podcast. Basically, you have this big machine thing that has switches and tubes that lead everywhere, and you put these little round wooden discs down across all around the machine, and then you basically slide this little slider between 1 and 5, which tells you which switch you're going to switch. You switch it, and then you follow it along, and you collect the gum gums, one of like 6 colors, as long as you can go. But sometimes you'll uncover a gum gum that leads you into another portion of the machine, whether it's a spinner or a crank that you got to move things around to move to another portion to go down and collect more gum gums. So it's like it's a cascading effect. And after TC talked about it last podcast, I was like, I got to see this thing in action. So Matt Wolf, being nefarious, tweeted, he's like, oh, I got to resist the miniature market sale. There's this huge clearance sale at miniature market. And then he goes, no, I can't resist. Who wants to order? So I took a look, and Gum Gum Machine was one of them that was on sale, along with Meeple War, which I picked up. I'll talk about it in a second. But I was like, "This, I got to pick this up." And I'm so glad that I did. It's perfect to play casually. Like, it was great with my mom and Lillian, and we just played it like four times and mixed and matched all the different bits and pieces of it. And it does have a memory element to it, especially depending on the certain modules that you put. You can mix and match the little spinner modules, and some of them have memory elements to it. But it's not overwhelming, and it's kind of like when you play with somebody who's not a Rain Man who's going to remember the entire board, it's fun because you go like, oh, I remember where that is, and you do this, and you kind of, you know, combo and cascade down on this machine, and it's just a lot of fun. So you should go on at least Board Game Geek and check out what it looks like as it's being played, or check out my Twitter feed because I got pictures of it as well. But I enjoyed it quite a bit. Now, TC, I can't remember. Did you like it when you played it?
Is this me?
Yeah. TC?
I hadn't played it.
You just talked about it.
I saw a review of it.
Oh, you saw a review.
Yeah, sorry. I had to let the dog out. I'm like running back in. No, I was just happy to hear that you were talking about Gum Gum Machine. And then, yeah, I just came in at there. Well, no, it just was a review. I was just watching one. I'm like, this is weird.
It was
I can't even remember who the designer is, but it's like a
Stefan Dora.
Yeah. Yeah.
And another designer. I'm sorry, I don't have the box with me, but it's him and another designer. And, you know, when you see that name, you're like, well, this is probably pretty good. It's weird. It is really weird. Yeah. And the whole concept behind it is weird. I don't know how they came up with the concept, but it plays super fun, and it's got a lot of player replayability because the individual modules can be mixed and matched with different combos of things you can do. Sometimes you'll be playing, and what happens is when you run to a black disc, you have to cap your Gum Gum, and that depends. You got this little measuring stick you get out, and you see how tall your Gum Gum is, and how tall it is how many points you get. And sometimes you'll be like, oh, I'm doing great, and then you'll get sent somewhere else, and you run into a black, and you'll have to cap it. And you're like, no, I want a bigger Gum Gum, and it's just hilarious, the conversations that happen around the game. But
just wanted a bigger Gum Gum.
I just want a bigger Gum Gum. But I highly recommend checking it out. It was perfect. I think on the sale it was $20, and it is well worth the $20 that I spent, because this is one that I'll actually put on the A-Team shelf because it's easy to break out and teach, and one that a lot of a mixed group can have fun with. So
cool.
So that's Gum Gum Machine. Adam O'Brien gave me his copy of Targi after I wanted to find it because I hadn't played it in a while, and now I wanted to teach it to Lillian. And I put a call out on Twitter, and he was like, no, you can just have mine. I was like, well, okay, I'm not going to turn that down. So we played it this weekend, and Targi is still awesome. I mean, it is one of the best two-player games, in my opinion, meaty two-player games that's ever been designed. And we played it twice. We each had a win each. And it's basically placing your targets, your people along the different grids, and where the intersections of the grids is, you get actions, and sometimes you can block people out. And there are also rotating cards that come in and out, and you're trying to build your tableau of tribes, and you get combos and not combos, but scores, but also discounts on certain things. Anyway, check out Targi.
It's just Gum Gum Machine in Africa.
yeah, exactly. It's pretty much the same thing. So really quickly, I also bought Meeple War, which was on sale, and it's basically you're each controlling a kingdom full of meeples, and you buy, you know, buildings that allow you to create more meeples and send them out into the land, and they battle with other meeples, and you're trying to tear down buildings and so on and so forth, and it is completely broken. And
actually called Meeple War?
It's called Meeple War, yeah.
That's unfortunate.
I don't think it's broken. It's just you feel like you can get, depending on how you build your buildings, you can get an endless loop with other people, and the game will last forever. But we played it 3-player. I want to try it again. 2-player, give it another shot, see if there's a way we can speed the game up a little bit. I like the components, and I love the concept. It's just, wow, it was lasting forever. So we finally decided, we're like, we're just going to call it quits and say we've played it, because it was like an hour and a half, and we had only like 2 victory points out of 6, and it was just getting nuts. I'm going to leave.
You didn't know this was the Twilight Imperium of Meeple War battle games.
I did not. It was just crazy. I was like expecting a quick war game, and it turned into Twilight Imperium. Meeple Imperium, the board game. and then the last two I'll just mention and we can move on. One is Pocket Madness, which is essentially I think it was Ludovic Malblanc and Bruno Cathala designed a little Cthulhu-based rummy game, which seems it seems cool on the surface, and it's fun playing the first round. But the setup is so intensive, and you have to play multiple rounds. The setup takes like 4 or 5 minutes, and between, and you play a round like in 3 minutes. So you're playing around, and then you have to set it up again. And I'm like, this is one.
Oh.
Speaking of the Meteor podcast, this is one that I think I can resurrect with a house rule for setup, and it won't change the meat of the game much at all. So anyway, and then the other thing that I finally bought was Kingsport Festival, the card game, which is the sped up little brother of Kingsport Festival that Daryl loves. I know Daryl loves this game.
Oh yeah, I love it. Actually, I you know what? I do, because if it wasn't for Kingsport, Fate of the Elder God wouldn't exist.
It is true. So that story was told way back when. But anyway, you're playing as the cultist, and you have a set of dice, and you have a set of cards in front of you, and you're basically building your hand out of the dice that you roll, and the cards you play, which are Haunt of the Dark, Mego, Shoggoth, things like that, can help you to modify your dice pool to build, to buy more powerful cards till you work your way up to the Ancient Ones, which is like Cthulhu and Shub-Niggurath and things like that, until finally, either after 9 rounds, you finish the game, or someone awakens Azathoth, which then ends the game immediately. You tally your points. You're also fighting against investigators, which have certain special abilities. And there's like 10 investigators or 12 investigators in the game, so you can mix and match, a lot of replayability. So we only played that once. I enjoyed it, but I definitely want to play it again to see how well it stands up, because the pyramid progression throughout the cards seems slightly predictable, in that we got a lot of the same cards, and it just depended on the order that we got them. So I want to try out with more groups just to see how well that replayability factors there. It was only $20 again, so a lot faster. I know I say it's only $20, and then you're just like, "Whoa, that's fun." $20 is $20, but I'm saying I think that right now I want to get my $20 worth out of it. I know I'll get my $20 worth out of Gum Gum Machine, and I already have, to be honest with you.
How could you not?
How could I not? It's, you know, I love making gum gums. They're delicious. All right. So before we move on to the meat of the podcast, and this will be very brief, but last podcast we talked about the one about intelligent design. And one of the things that we mentioned in the conversation that came up was about me getting a production quote for Take the Bait.
Silly.
Stop. So let's give some context here. And the production quote for Take the Bait is basically, Take the Bait was one that I developed quite a long time ago with Sherilyn, and it's one that I've resurrected, a design that I'm starting to look at again. But I had the idea, I wanted to see, first of all, I wanted to get an updated quote for the actual game that as it exists, to see if I can improve on the production value and take something out or add something in, see where I'm looking at for a rooster size game. But I wanted to see what it would cost if I tried to pare it down to a comparable monkey. So I got production quotes for that as well. And so that sparked a debate between me and TC about designers shouldn't get production quotes for their designs before the designs are finished. Seth Jaffe chimed in about that and said that he agreed with that. And it actually sparked quite a good debate on Twitter, which you can check out by looking at Seth Jaffe's feed or looking through things like that. I'll try to include a link to the actual Twitter conversation on the podcast. But the overall gist of it was some people sided and said there's no harm in getting that information first. And some people said, no, it's foolish to get a production quote before you've designed your game, because, well, you know, you want to design your game by the game that's supposed to be and not necessarily have to worry 100% about what it's going to cost, so on and so forth. My personal stance, and especially what we talked about on the podcast, was for me, the reason why I did it is because, number one, I have experience in publishing, so I just wanted to get a good overall window, see a little bit into the process, so I can understand, is it worth pursuing as a rooster? Would it be worth pursuing as a monkey? And also, if it is as a monkey, I started thinking that of ways that I could pare the game down and intelligent ways that I could do that. So I used the design constraint to foster intelligent design for me. Now, what TC and Seth's, well, mostly what TC was saying, was like, don't do that because you're going to hamstring yourself, just design the game to design the game. But I also pointed out that the rabbits existed because there was a design constraint and people designed intelligently around that. Those things, both myself getting the production quote for Take the Bait plus the design constraint of the rabbits, are exceptions to the rule. I don't think there's any harm in getting information or a designer getting information about their game, but I don't necessarily think that every single designer needs to go and say, like, well, I've got an idea for a game. Maybe I should see how much it costs. Because the design of that game is going to change a lot during playtesting. It's going to change a lot during certain things that you do during the actual development process. So, in my personal opinion, I think knowledge is fine, but you should also moderate it with, I guess, you should not use it as like the end-all be-all of what your game should be. So I don't know, TC, if you're still listening, but
I'm still there.
All right.
No, I agree. I mean, but I guess you just brought it up because why not? but it was funny. It was because, you know, I mean, you don't want to put yourself in a situation, at least for new designers. I mean, that was the thing. It was like, give examples for new designer, give help to new designers last time. And that was, that would be bad advice to give, is go get a quote for your yeah. game while it's an early in development. Right.
I agree. I agree with that.
Wait till later. And then if you really need to know like specifics, just ask another designer, I think, right? Like until you get to the point where you're like, well, I'm looking at a publisher, or maybe I want to self-publish this, and I need to make sure that I only have 3 punch boards that have tokens on them, then you could start thinking about that. But until then, just try to get rid of as many components as possible in your game, and then you're good. Plan on a rabbit every time, and then just make a dragon.
Just make a rabbit. Make a dragon out of a rabbit. Yeah, exactly. It's perfect. I just want to bring it up again because it was a fascinating conversation. And obviously, some of you out there may have opinions. We do want to hear that. Find us on Twitter. Chime in. Talk on the actual guild on Board Game Geek. Just let us know. So anyway, that's enough of that. Let's move on to the meat of the podcast. All right. So, house rules. Everybody's played with them at one time or another. And these are little rules that game groups or families add or subtract to games that they play often. Now, I guess it doesn't have to be often. Sometimes you can play a game and after the first play, you're like, well, let's get rid of that rule and play again or do something else. But what we want to kind of bring up for a discussion is some classic examples, but also the actual existence of house rules. One of the most classic examples that I wanted to throw out there is, I'm pretty sure we've all played Monopoly at one time where we put money that was made from jail under free parking, and the first person to land on free parking got that money. Have we all played that way with Monopoly?
Of course.
That's just the way you play.
And well, not just that, but also the taxes that you pay have to go to the
right.
To the
anything center. That's paid to the bank from the board itself is usually thrown under free parking, and then whoever landed on free parking was woo rich. So
yes,
I've only played it once, and then we didn't play that way.
Oh, that's right. You were new. You played. What was it, last year or year before?
Yeah, I think it was last year.
That just blows my mind still to this
well,
day.
Well, I'm sure I had played it as a kid, but never to completion. And it was so long ago, I don't remember how it played then.
So you didn't play it using putting the jail, but you also played the digital version, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you can't take, it's like everybody's paying with these debit cards, so you can't take the money and just slide it under free parking.
Yeah.
Man, you're missing out on one of the best parts of playing Monopoly.
Yes, sure.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, pretty much everybody out there listening, except with the exception of Jessica, has played Monopoly and used free parking as an example of a house rule. So I just find that it's a fascinating example of a rules meme, and that's pretty much what house rules are. They're kind of a meme. It's a spoken or folkloric type of thing that's passed from one person to the other or is generated in a game group that can help them to modify certain things. So I just want to open up the discussion to everybody. First of all, why do you think house rules exist? Like, why are they there?
I think, well, one reason that immediately comes to mind is if a rule book's not clear, you just go, what makes the most sense? And you just run with that. The other thing is if it's a game that's too fiddly or too complicated, and once again, your group figures out, or you, because it's your house, figure out an easier or cleaner way or just a better way or more preferred way to do it, you run with that. And that's just what you do. So that would be that. Otherwise, I guess the third way would be is if you've been playing it wrong for so long, you're just used to it, and you're just like, well, screw it, that's how we're playing it. So
that's true. Well, what about Magic when they like say something's banned? That would be kind of a house rule. That's not even a house rule, I guess. It's more of a
more of a tournament thing. So like, if you're not playing a tournament, you're just the guy that's, or the person rather, that's just being a dick for playing a card that is broken.
Yeah, but do you think? I mean, they're obviously Magic groups. I mean, like Warhammer 40K, we would play. It's the same type of concept where there were some things that got banned officially, but there were also things that got banned within certain groups because they didn't like it being in the game.
Right, and it's the same way with Magic. So there's Standard, Modern, Legacy, and Vintage, and so they'll ban things like, oh, you can't play this card in Legacy anymore, or you can't play this card in, you know, a Standard anymore, or it's restricted, so you can only have one of this card in these decks now. And but it typically, most people will hone their decks when that happens to get rid of those cards or to kind of abide by the rules. Anyone that doesn't, it's just kind of like, look, I know it's broken, I know that's why it's banned, I'm going to play a deck that shows you why it was banned, as if anyone really wants to see that. So, it's kind of like the, hey, this smells really bad, Here, smell it.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what?
Well, that's, I mean, that to the same example of 40K, we use the term cheese, and it's like, man, you won't believe this Eldar thing. You got to play against these Eldar. It's like, no, I don't. Why? It's like, oh, so cheesy. Like, it's the same thing. It's like, here, smell this. It's so cheesy. You know, and you're like, well, I don't want to play that way. Anyway.
I was thinking like, I mean, just to this, I mean, like, well, I was thinking like games where I want to say like when the game design's bad, but it's not necessarily that case. It's kind of like, I know a lot of people that play like dungeon crawls and like Blood Bowl, things like that, and they just make, or Talisman even, it's like they just make rules that make it more fun for their group and maybe fix some of the issues that pop up.
All right, so Talisman is a good example because everybody, you can play Talisman by the rules if you want to, but nobody plays Talisman by the rules. Because it's one of those games, it's like Monopoly, where it has this kind of a living thing around it. And people who play Talisman a lot, or play together with groups a lot, they all go like, alright, don't do this, or don't do that, or I'm not going to sit around and let you, you know, dick around for an hour instead of going up and trying to get the crown. You're just kind of going around and seeing if you can turn into a toad. Just, you know, don't do that. You know, it's there are certain, and it's so loose that it needs to have some sort of structure that the rules don't always give.
You can play for 5 hours just because.
Right, you can. Just because. Absolutely, you absolutely can. Well, so let's move on to this. So do you think that many people even recognize a house rule because they're taught a game by someone else and don't bother to read the rules themselves? Like, can they... Like, I think, Daryl, you mentioned house rules might exist because you've been taught from someone else and you don't even know the difference.
Yes. Yeah, and well, that was the way we played with Puerto Rico until TC came down and going, why are you playing it this way? And it was something with the captain. I forget what we were doing wrong now because TC's way made far more sense, and that was the rule. So, you know, thankfully that made more sense. But it was,
I think it was just it wasn't happening in turn order. Like you could just put whatever you wanted or something like that.
No.
I can't remember what it was.
No, is if someone, all right, so if I put coffee on a boat and it had spaces and it came to you, if you had coffee,
everyone,
you had to put it on the coffee boat. You couldn't go to an empty boat or anything else. Like, you had to, you were forced. And so when we played before TC, whoever pulled the captain, it was like the dick move. It was the, well, I'm going to blow up your collection. Like, boom, there you go. And you're like, ah, why?
Yeah.
There's a, you know, and I mean, the captain is still that way. Like, if someone, you know, has the five coffee, they're going to grab the five boat, and that makes sense. But before, it was like, well, I'm going to put my one coffee on this boat, forcing you to get rid of all of yours so I can get the bigger collection, blah, blah, blah. And that fixed a lot. The other one was you would pull one position, and then I'm trying to remember which way we did it now. So that's my issue with Puerto Rico. Like, anytime I play it, I kind of have to refresh the rule on this thing, is that if I pulled the craftsman, then everyone would, I would do the craftsman action and everyone else would do it. and then Chris would pull, you know, the trader, and then everyone did. Where I think in the past, I would pull the mayor, Chris would pull the craftsman, Steph would, would pull whatever. And then we'd go around doing each one of those things. So it just, it was like little tweaks. Like, it was still right, but it was just the way that we did it made it more confusing. So,
But you tried to make it more confusing for yourself. That's a terrible house rule.
That's a terrible house rule.
Yeah, I think that's the worst example.
The thing was, it wasn't a house rule. It was the rules. Yeah. Like, that's how we had it. That was how you play. And so that's what we did. And thankfully, TC came and slapped us and said, no.
And no. We've been playing it right.
Correct ever since, yeah. Anything else we house rule? Elder sign. Before the expansions, we house ruled where you could not buy an elder sign for the 10 trophy points.
Yeah, and that's that just felt
overpowered. Yeah. And that got rid of it. So it was like, okay, cool.
A lot of people played that way. Well, that's also not something that's on the script that we're going for. We're usually off script. But anyway, there's also another point of that too, where there are actually updated versions of games that come out because there are people have made it popular of a certain house rule, and a publisher recognizes it and goes, you know what? We're going to update the rule for this to be the original rule, and we're going to stick it in there. Either as a variant or the standard rule with the old way as a variant, things like that. I think there's one that's actually on TC's personal house rules list that got into a game. And that would
What you're saying, yes, but before
we get
say
there,
it, right?
Yes,
before we say it, like that one came up. That's I'll talk about that in a little bit because that's not an accidental one,
no,
right? Like that was like on purpose, right? And for me, my accidental one is usually related to like party games,
right? Okay,
I'll go with like Cards Against Humanity. There's a lot of people who have played. Apples to apples, but they play like Cards Against Humanity, and they won't know that there's actually points, right? Like, I mean, if you go by the rules,
there's actually a point, right? Exactly.
And no one does. So, I mean, I've seen people play and like that.
You just
go through the deck like
a time
and a half, right. And then you stop, right? Yeah.
Same thing with Concept. It's like Concept has a point system, but nobody cares what the point system is.
Exactly.
Illustrations.
Telestrations, right. You just play to laugh.
Wait, does Telestrations have points?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Wow. Yeah, I mean, see, there, I'm telling you, like, those games where you just have an activity that's fun, why add points?
Yeah.
It doesn't even matter.
I'll say that of the party games that do kind of have, like, winners and losers in it, like, Time's Up Title Recall has a very easy system to keep up with, and it's just one of those things that you still play the game within the system of the game. There's not tons of house rules, but you're basically just playing to have fun anyway. But it's just very easy and organic and natural to follow. But most of the ones that have these convoluted, weird point systems, nobody cares. They're just having fun.
I just we had a game of code names, and one person just yelled out Scorpion Zero for his clue. And what he meant was, you'll get automatic. You can't do that, by the way, in that game. But like, what he meant to do by saying that was, you automatically get a free guess. Just don't pick Scorpion.
See, that's cheating.
No.
It's totally cheating. Yeah.
You cannot do that.
And of course, they were just like, wait, Scorpion Zero. Well, I guess we'll pick the ones like Scorpion related.
Oh, God. That's horrible.
Oh, I just think of Scorpion Zero every time I play.
Scorpion code Zero. Names. Coordinate code names. Actually, that sounds like an operation. Code name Scorpion Zero. All right. So, well, we're starting to move down into the actual house rules. We've talked about some accidental ones and playing games by the wrong rules simply because you've been taught. Again, it all comes down to, I think that the prevalence of the house rule system has not really changed very much because a lot of the classic games, there weren't as many games from our childhood. It wasn't as big of a variety as there is now. But we also have, with the advent of the variety, the internet, and we're able to talk with more people and experience games with more people, and people talk about variants you can play with, where in the old days it was basically, hey, I want to play Monopoly. Well, I'll play Monopoly. I'll teach you how to play this. And then they spread the house rules around. So what classic games? Let's talk about classic games that we've played where there was a house rule in place. We mentioned Monopoly already. And I also want to ask, as part of this question, how do you really know it was a house rule? Like, have you gone back and checked the rules? Do you know it's a house rule? Things like that.
Yeah, I didn't know that Uno had points.
Uno has points?
My whole life.
Uno has points?
Yes, you play until somebody reaches 500 points.
500 like points?
So you end up, I've played it like that. Once I read the rules and saw that in the rule book, you play like 5 or 6 rounds to determine who's the winner.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, wow. And well, I can't remember how you add, I think it's, I can't remember how you add up the points. Oh, like maybe that's that triggers the loser and whoever has the fewest points wins or something like that. So yeah, I had no idea. But when I got into gaming a couple of years ago, I bought a copy of Uno's Avengers edition or Marvel edition at Walmart. Yeah, and Avengers. So I read the rule book because there's a couple of different rules in there because of an Avengers card or something. And when I saw that you actually add points up every round, I was like, what? I had no idea my entire life.
Wow.
That's weird.
That's weird.
That's a good example though.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of like weird classic games. It's tough because, I mean, I think there's a lot of people out there that would have more classic games. Now I'm so far away from these classic games, I can't remember anymore. I just remember most of the house rules that we used were to make the game shorter. Because I don't know what's wrong. Like, I remember playing Boulder Dash, and that score track, it just goes on forever.
Oh, it does go on
forever.
It could
be like 5 hours of game. I'm like, no one wants to play this game. We're already sick of it at this point.
Well, Trivial Pursuit was the same way. Like, unless you were really good at Trivial Pursuit, because you rolled and moved and did all these other things, like, we would play to a certain amount.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Did you play the that's a good one. Trivial Pursuit house rule where no matter where you land, you can get a piece.
Yes.
Okay, because we played that, because that's so much better.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You're landing on that, you've got a chance to get a piece, not just on the ends. And then if you go up through the middle, you, of course, get the wild in the middle, all these different things. But, like, I think Trivial Pursuit's one that's been house-ruled quite a bit. We used to do handicaps on Trivial Pursuit, because I was really good at Trivial Pursuit, depending on the edition, obviously. It wasn't like, I was still decent at Genus Edition, but nobody's good at Genus Edition except for, like, Ken Jennings or somebody. But, you know, I would play, and we'd have mixed groups where he was like, well, you got to get two of those right to get a pie, you know, and I'm just like, come on, let's not do that.
Yeah, that's good. It's good. I like those.
But those, I mean, yeah, I think certain of those classic games, and Monopoly, of course, we've already mentioned the free parking, but Monopoly as well, it's like the whole auction system. A lot of people don't play with the auction system. But it totally speeds the game up. So everybody complains about Monopoly taking forever. I'm like, well, if you play by the rules, you can get it done in like 30 minutes to like 40 minutes if you play house. Like, you know, actually cutthroat Monopoly. And they're like, no, it lasts like 8 hours. I'm like, well, first of all, you auction. If somebody doesn't want to buy a property, you auction it off. You don't just put it back until somebody else buys it. You don't play where everybody can get money off of free parking. You don't do deals where it's like, you don't have to pay me that. Just like, you know, give me a little bit now, and then later, it just, you know, cut me a break if I land on one of your properties. The kind of nice Monopoly. Like,
yeah, nice Monopoly.
Yeah, and it lasts 8
open,
hours.
Open dealing Monopoly, yeah. You can have a loan for forever and ever.
Right.
Just keep loaning.
And everybody feels that they can do that with Monopoly, which is a strange phenomenon. And
you just never want the fun to end. Come on.
It's true. All right. Well, let's move on to this question. Do you personally like house rules, or are you more of a stickler for the written rules? And I know that there are people who want to play the game exactly by the rules and don't want to play with variants at all. They want to have it exactly the way the designer intended. But in our group, do you mind house rules? Do you like house rules, or do you like sticking to the written rules?
Rules are good. I like printed rules.
Does it make you uncomfortable to break from the regular rules?
So it kind of does a little bit for some reason. Like, even if people like do moves too fast so that other people can't see what they're doing, I don't like that either.
Yeah, like Carcassonne, you could flip a tile over and look at it before it's your turn.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Some people
right.
don't like that.
I like to do things the way they've been laid out for you to do. that's my personality type. So
I like to see it work. Like, I want to play it the way that the designer intended until it like doesn't work for some reason, or it slows the game down, or it makes it fiddly. Like, if it's written in a certain way and you're just like, ah, we're just gonna do this, right? Like, and when you do it, you're just like, that was so much faster and so much better, right? Like,
yeah, I have an example of that later for one game.
okay good. Yeah, because I mean, I'll give everything a shot first time and be like, I gotta do it this way. And especially because you usually get rules wrong on the first try, give it a second try. If I enjoy the game and want to play it again, I'm gonna give it a second try and then maybe just check and make sure that we got all the rules right.
Yeah.
But after that, like, if something's still like nagging you and something's weird, or like, I don't know, I no longer worry about hurting anybody's feelings. I just change it just a little bit.
Yeah, I think I do the same thing, where I'm definitely going to play the game the first time with the written rules. I mean, you should.
Mm-hmm.
And what I see a lot of times, though, is like, well, part of the Dice Eight Games philosophy is like, well, we can include a couple of variants that we've played with, which are pretty much developmental house rules, where you just try a couple of new things that you can get people thinking of, well, maybe we'll play this way and see how it goes. But for the most part, most games don't have that. So you definitely want to play the rules for the first time, and then you go like, man, that rule makes no sense. Like, why don't we change it to this? And everybody goes, yeah, let's try that. You know, I don't do that with every game, obviously, but there are a couple of games that you'll play that you find promise in the game and you want to play the game, but at the same time, you find yourself wanting to play another way, and everybody else who's playing it with you feels the same way, and you go like, well, what's the harm? Let's just play that way, you know?
Yeah.
All right, so let's move on to this. This is the fun part. So, what games have you or your game group or family created house rules for? And I know all of you out there listening, we're going to talk through several on our list here. There are several of you out there who are going to have some cool house rules to games. So, please, please chime in. Comment on the podcast on DiceHateMe.com. Comment on the Guild. Find us on Twitter. Whatever it takes. But comment, because we want to hear your house rules. Because these are cool. They're fun that we can all try out with games that we've either played in the past or we'd like to play.
Always add a dexterity element too.
Absolutely. It's whoever can
flick your meeple onto the worker placement spot you want.
And if you land on it, you get a bonus. Well, Daryl, I mean, I know you struggled with this, but do you have any on your list?
If anything, it's pretty much anything I ever play with Ethan. For the most part, I mean, now that he's older, we don't do it as much. But, like, we did it with Ticket to Ride. We came up with a family-friendly version of Ticket to Ride before First Journey came out. Just things like that. I mean, typically I try to stick to the rules as much as I can. My own stuff, I will pull a Lanius drink and bend my own rules a little bit. Because it's like, well, you know, it's more or less, let's try it this way, let's try it that way. And that's typically a lot with prototypes, but that doesn't really count for house rules. But, yeah, I really couldn't think of anything that's just like, oh, yes. And I even asked Leslie this. I'm like, do we do anything where it's just like, this is how we're playing this game? Like, forget what the rules say, this is how we do it. And she's like, I can't really. And then she even brought up, she goes, Ticket to Ride with Ethan when he was younger. And I'm like, yeah, that's all I could think of, too. So, I'm sorry. I was racking my brain hard. Like, I went out to the game room and looked at all the games. I was like, is there anything that just jumps out? And I couldn't think of anything.
That's right. Okay. Maybe we'll jog your memory.
Yeah, you might remember something as we're talking about stuff.
That's very, very possible. But
yeah. Well, TC, what do you got?
I put like two examples because I was thinking in the designer term for me. Like, I made house rules. There's other examples, but I'll do two real quick that I was like, well, like, is it a bad design or is it like did they make a choice? And one of the things that I use my own game and like Space Dealer. So like a long time ago, we played Space Dealer and we played it like 13 times in a row this one weekend, and somewhere
13 times.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was a lot. And this is real-time space game. So if you've seen Time and Space is the newer version of it, which I actually think is not as good. I think the older one is better. It's a little bit more fiddly, but it's... I don't know. Maybe I have nostalgia. It's probably nostalgia. But we played this all in this one weekend, right? Just kept playing the Space Dealer game because we really liked the idea that it was real-time trading in space and you're all doing this thing, like with the multiple sand timers. So you're just flipping the sand timers when they run out to take actions, and you're moving your ships around and trying to move goods from one place to another. And every time that you build an upgrade in your space station, it creates a need for the other player to fill. So they could bring like blue cubes over to your blue station, and you could bring this thing over to theirs, right? And you're making deals real time and doing all this stuff. And as a three-player game, it worked really well. Except about two or three games in, we realized that like there was always this like initial race where you would want to get to the highest level of technology. It was like level 3. And it took like six flips of this 30-second timer to get there. So, I mean, it's a big percentage of the time that you're doing is just taking these actions just to do that. And that's all you're doing. But it allowed you to get like upgrades so that you could ship goods better. And in this case, the level 3s were the best upgrades in the game. And you got to choose which one you wanted. And one of them was so overpowered that you would always go for it. And so the first person that would get there would always pick that one. And then the next, there was another one that was like second most overpowered by a big margin. And then another big gap between like the next two. And they were like they were actually the same. So it was like the first person got rewarded for going to 3, and everybody else got kind of screwed. And the problem is, it's like basically you would just rush at the beginning to get there. So we house ruled it where we put the cards in a specific order. So if you got there first, you got the worst upgrade, and if you got there later, you got the second worst upgrade, right? Like that kind of thing. So we just had 3 players, we put them in order of 3, and so the best upgrade was the last person that did it, and it really solved a lot of problems. And so I mean, I look at it and I go, is that like, was that a design decision they made that was like too hard for them? Like you had to put them in a certain order at the beginning. I don't know, but I think it was just kind of they didn't have someone that wanted to play test the game 13 times. and could tell them immediately that that was a problem. But they should have picked up on that, right? But my counterexample is myself. I look at that and I go, wait, was that a bad design decision? And we're just fixing it. In 2-player Xenon Profiteer, I made a design choice to not change anything. So that when you open up the book, you learn the 3-player rules, 4-player, 2-player rules, and 5 players, and then kick out one person because it's only 4 players. You could play with 2 and have the exact same rules. And I knew ahead of time that, like, even though I'm making this decision, there's a first player advantage in the game. So I'm making a sacrifice here to make it simple. I'm making a design sacrifice, right? Like, I know that you should probably give the second player something to make up for the fact that the other player gets to go first. And I didn't. But on Board Game Geek, I've just made a house rule. Just give the other person an extra dollar. And I think that I think that fixes it, actually. I think that's just perfectly fine.
DC, why didn't you just add that to the rule book?
Because I don't want people to, because you have to open it up, and then people think, well, that opens up the next can of worms. Like, well, then why doesn't, when you play 3 players, don't I get something else? Because that's obviously a, no, it's not.
I don't know that you're brilliant and you did that to balance the game.
Yeah, I know, but then if you do it with the 2 players, then you have to do it with the 3. Then you have right. to do it with the 4. And each one, and I'm just like, nah. It's not even, like, it really isn't an advantage. It's like an advantage, but it's not big enough. Ah, whatever. But I made the design. I made the choice to make it simple and streamlined, and maybe it was wrong. Maybe it wasn't. But you can easily house rule it, and that's why I put it on Board Game Geek. Like house rule it. Give the other person a dollar. Great, you're done. So anyway, that's me. That's my story.
That's your story, and you're sticking to it.
Yep, and I'll get into the other ones, but that's my first story.
Well, we can move into the other ones that we have here in a second, which kind of harkens back to some design examples that have been brought up by people who are house ruling as a group that got on Board Game Geek or passed around. But anyway, before we get to that, let's go to Jessica. We know that you love printed rules. It's here in all caps for all of us in the show notes. But you do. I mean, you've mentioned before, like with Uno. So go ahead and take it away. Well, yeah. What do you have?
I mean, I can only think of like one lame example. Like I've only been gaming for a couple years, and I know people like you and a bunch of neophytes that have new games all the time. So I'm always playing new games. So it's almost like not even a chance to play a game for a second time and learn that there's a house rule. But one is with Terraforming Mars. Technically, the rules say that whoever is the first player is the dealer for the round. But I've played this game like 23 times, and half the time I've taught it. And because there are just so many things going on in the game for every round, I basically am just the dealer for the entire game. It just makes it a little bit easier and less fiddly. So
my God, just kind of you have changed the game forever.
I know.
You've ruined the true randomness of the deck.
And I'm going to steal one and say code names. You just don't use the timer.
Yep. You're going to steal it off my list.
I've never used it. So yeah.
The other time.
No, wait. Do you don't use it like at all?
No. So, typically, unless I'm playing with Brian. I don't know if you guys played with my friend Brian at PressCon, but he can be slow.
Yeah,
so,
I just use it as a dick timer. It's like if we have to pick that up during the game, it's because somebody's
being stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's time.
Yeah, exactly. And that was on my list as well. It's like that's
I love you, Brian.
that should just be in the rules. It's just like, well, we put a timer in here, but you don't really need to use it unless somebody's being a dick.
Well, but Jessica, don't you like the house rule in Fleet where you can't let Chris get shrimp for $4 at the beginning? That's
pretty
the best
sure that's
house
only
rule.
In your house. That's only your house. Although when I play with people, for some reason they've heard you say that, and I never get shrimp anymore.
You should never get it. I think it should just be an automatic house rule. Just
it
like
should be in the,
if someone
like next edition rule book.
Exactly. Yeah. Don't let anyone get shrimp for $4.
It's just this little italicized thing that says if you're playing with Chris Kirkman, never let him get shrimp in the opening for $4. I'm like, I'll never be able to play that game with anybody ever again. All right, I've got a lot, but it's only because like I've played with a lot of gaming groups where we kind of add things and do different things. And one of them on my list is not on here, but I'm going to mention first classic games, which some of you have not played. But one of them is Fireball Island. And I've mentioned it several times on the podcast that I'm notorious in that game for wearing people down because I'll go and grab the jewel and hide in the caves and just keep going from cave to cave to cave until everybody gets tired of playing, and then I jump out and win. And so our game group eventually had the house rule of I can't go from cave to cave. I have to go to a cave, pop out, at least move. Then I could try to go back to the other cave, or I can go to another cave, hide again, and it made the game a little bit more interesting. I don't know. I think it was probably the intent of the original design. The fact that you at least have to exit the cave and stand in the way of a possible fireball come flying at you. But, you know, it's just one of those rules that over time my entire group said, well, we'll play Fireball Island with you if we get to play with this. And I'm like, okay, fine. Even my friend Scott, who is the biggest stickler, because I would say, okay, this is how you play, and I'd do all the different things, and then we'd play, and then something would happen, and I'd go, well, this is what happens. And he goes, that's not right. Give me the rules. And he'd read through the rules, trying to find the right rule. And he'd go, well, whatever. The rules are stupid. We shouldn't play with that, you know. So he's the perfect house rule person.
Those are the types of rules that you definitely need the house rule.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, it's true.
Infinite loops of old games.
Exactly. And that happens sometimes with old games. One of the games that my lunch group, back when I worked before I quit to go full time doing publishing and things, we used to play Bang a lot. And I actually have two articles that I'll link with this podcast on DiceHateMe.com that I originally wrote for DiceHateMe.com about some of our house rules for Bang. And Bang is one of those it's very fun because it's a social deduction game, but you're playing a lot of cards and things. But sometimes the game itself can stretch out because there's limitations on who you can hit. And so in throughout our experience playing the game, we figured out ways that we could play the game with 6-7 players during lunch and not run over that hour time. So one of the things that always annoyed us in Bang was people riding Mustangs. And so we ruled that instead of targeting the person, you could shoot the player's Mustang with a Bang card. I know it was really, it's pretty grim, but we're like, because the Mustang would just be passed around. It's like, you know, you shoot the person, but you still got the Mustang, and then all of a sudden they get on the Mustang. It's just a pain in the butt to hit somebody or to deal with somebody who's riding a Mustang. So we would shoot the horse. Now, they had a chance to, of course, play a missed card just as normal, but we could target the horse instead of the rider, so we could take the stupid card out. And but because we put that in there, we ruled that if your horse got shot, you could use it for cover and play it like a barrel card. So we got kind of creative with some of these house rules, but it all made sense. We're like, well, hide behind the carcass, you know? It's like, you know...
No horses were harmed.
No horses were harmed in this house rule, but they really were. Only cardboard horses. So we also had a few other variants, but the most important variant that we put in was the range on the panic card. And panic is one of those that kind of gets a little, I don't know. You can only play panic at a one range. It has a one on it. And it just doesn't make any sense that panic has a one on it, because you can only steal from your neighbors. And let's say you get into a weird situation where you're the sheriff and you got panic in your hand and you've got deputies on either side of you. Yes, you could steal from this. You could protect yourself, which is the ultimate goal of the game, but it's just annoying. And also sometimes there's somebody who's ticking you off across the table and you want to be able to reach them. So one of our house rules that I still play to this day, no matter what, when I'm teaching Bang, I teach that you can do this, is that panic is at the range of your gun. So if you have a scope, or you know, you have a gun that has a longer range on it, like a rifle, then your panic, you can actually panic someone up to the range of whatever you could actually shoot that person at. And that actually improves the game quite a bit, because you got a lot of game things that can change hands. You got somebody that maybe hiding behind a barrel or has something else, and you can snag their barrel. Or if you choose to play with the dead horse, then you can snag their carcass, you know, things like that. It just helps to speed the game up quite a bit. So there's a lot more. Matter of fact, if you want to go check out all the different house rules we came up with for Bang, there are a lot, and they're pretty fun. You can check on that with the link at dicehateme.com. Clue, of course, we have a house rule for Clue. I play Clue normally by the full-on rules, but some people get tired of it. And so one of the things is that whenever you accuse someone that's in the game, like let's say TC's playing Miss Scarlet, and I accuse Miss Scarlet, then Miss Scarlet has to be placed into the room that you're at accusing her. And so you spend a whole, like, half the game getting to this one room so you can ask a question in that room, and then all of a sudden you're questioned by someone, you're thrown into another room. You don't have to do that. And then at the very end of the game, you don't have to move to the room that you want to guess at to be there for the final guess. You can just move into a room and make a guess. So that speeds the game up some. Also, a lot of people don't...
Seem reasonable, actually.
Yeah.
Man, is it annoying to just get... I mean, at least from the past. I haven't played Clue in so long. But yeah, it was super annoying to get moved whenever people would play like that. And I knew a lot of groups that just did not play like that. So yeah, they didn't even read the rules enough to know that that was a rule.
Right. And it is a rule. And it's like, it's there. And it's like, if you play with really savvy Clue players, they'll use it to their advantage to try to pull you away from getting the clues that you need. But it can get really annoying. So with casual Clue players, don't play that way. One of the famous house rules was Agizia. No touching the water ring.
Which is not a house rule.
It is a house rule, too.
That is an enforceable pact.
Yeah, you're right. It is a pact.
That people make, even though they should not, so that they can lose.
And also that you could break and risk having someone smash your face in. So, yep. Yeah. That's just best left unspoken. So don't make that pact in Agizia.
But you can go back. You can go back to like episode 4.
Oh yeah.
Something like that.
It's like
the story behind that.
Absolutely. It's like episode, it's literally like episode 4 probably of State of the Games. You'll find this episode. Possibly. You'll find the sordid details of no touching the water ring in Agizia. The other thing that I always play with that people get annoyed with sometimes is I don't play with farmers in Carcassonne. I hate it. I'm just like, I want to play Carcassonne. I'm going to play casual. I don't have to do the spatial, like, Rain Man calculations of where all my farm goes. No, forget it. Don't want to do it. Don't have to deal with it.
Whatever.
One of the house rules that I don't particularly play with, but I've played with groups who play with it, is the in Kingdom Builder, you can actually have two cards in your hand instead of just the one. I actually like having the one because then you're forced to kind of do your best with the one card that you have, but some people like having at least two. It does slow the game down slightly, but not terribly so. I don't mind playing with the house rule when somebody suggests it. And the last one that I have on my list is Alien Frontiers. Some people play, because they don't know the difference, but whenever you use a die as a six and you tear it apart to terraform the surface, you're supposed to leave that ship in dock until the beginning of your next turn, and then it goes away. But some people say as soon as it's terraformed, it exits that dock, and so now other people can terraform really quickly with that. That's not true. So I believe, Daryl, you and I have played at one time where we were even debating that rule, and I can't remember if it was you who said it went away immediately or I said it went away. Anyway, it took us like 10 minutes of arguing back and forth till we finally looked it up and go, oh, well, that is the rule, you know. So it's,
if I had a dollar for every single game I've played where there's an argument over how things are defined in rules, I'd be very rich.
So that's kind of my list, and that's really, I mean, I've played with other groups that have had other house rules, and there's even been games even recently where I've played a game where I'm just like, next time we play, let's try this. And sometimes we will, sometimes we won't. But I want to return back to something that's on TC's list, and it's when we were talking about sometimes that house rules can become the actual norm for a game. So you have one on your list that's actually happened.
Yeah, so I mean, in our fix, this was for Brewcrafters. I think early one of the criticisms of Brewcrafters, which I knew was a criticism because it just had been for a while, but that was the start player spot. That and I just absolutely hated it whenever I played it with Chris on on camera, because I was like, no, don't do that, because you're going to just show people how you could just kill that spot. But no, basically in Brewcrafters, the start player spot does double duty. You can take the top one or you can take the bottom part, right? But what the problem is that if someone takes the bottom part, the top part just gains money and stays open, but no one can go there. So what Chris did in the video, and which you should do, is if you're first player, you should, not on the first turn, but on the second turn, take the start player spot and take something that's on it, or whatever you can do, so that you take the start player spot and gum it up so that no one else can take it, because the stuff on the bottom of it is good. So there was these times where if you played like a dick, you could just take that spot, and for the entire first round, it would never change hands. It would just go to the first player. And I was like, that's just, yeah. So my house rule was that you could, that two people could go to that spot. That was not safe.
Right.
That star player spot could be done. But in the new edition, there's even a better rule than that.
Yeah, now we've changed it where the standard game, you can still play in the old way, which I like to call, you know, the pro way. I'm just saying. No, I'm just kidding. No, it's just an alternate way. But the standard way to play now in the second edition and beyond Brewcrafters is that you can go to the first player marker has been moved down to the fundraiser space. And the fundraiser space was only used sporadically in case you just needed some extra inflow of cash. But now the fundraiser space doubles as also the start player space as well. So if you really do want to get start player, you can go and grab it down there. And it doesn't gum up the form local partnership space, which is what they used to double up as. So now somebody's not always taking over both of them. So if somebody really wants the form local partnership or a really important spot, now they can go down to fundraiser, grab the first player token. It's much more open that way. But we do have the old way on the backside of the main market action board now. So if anybody wants to play with that more tight, and some people say dickish version of Brewcrafters, you can. But that was fine. And we debated that for a long time. You know, Ben Rossett talked about it for a long time. I debated it. I talked about it with you guys for quite a bit. And I eventually relented and said, yes, you know what? This is worth giving people options in the game and actually making the base game of Brewcrafters be a little bit more open with those two changes. And that was all based around house rules. You know, TC was the first ones who did that, but a lot of other people who got the game were saying, like, well, this is too tight. Let's figure out a workaround, and they did.
Yep.
Yeah.
My other two were just Tiny Epic Galaxies. At the end of your turn, gain a culture if you have zero. So kind of, I don't know, Roll for the Galaxy has this awesome rule which I love. And it's the fact that, like, you can never get $0. You can all, you, whenever you go down to zero, you always get $1 back for the start of the next turn. And so using that same rule in Tiny Epic Galaxies for culture means the world, because there are times in that game, it's one of those games where you can follow other people's actions. But anytime you follow, you have to pay a culture. I assume it's a culture. I think it's just a culture. Yeah. I haven't played in a little bit. But yeah, you just pay one culture, and you can follow whatever action they just took. But if you get down to zero culture and you're playing with four people, you just sit there. So, like, you just kind of you either have to tell people, yeah, just be careful with your culture. But if there's just no culture planets out, you could just sit there and just, like, now it just becomes a turn by turn game. Like, no one can get culture, so you just sit there. And that's just really not the intent, I think. So very simply, you just get one culture if you ever have zero at the end of your turn. And it allows people to follow. Just one time, it speeds up the game just a little bit, and it just makes the world of a difference. It's a really good house rule, at least for me. I like it. And then Lords of Waterdeep, a lot of people take out the mandatory quests.
I think those people are weak.
Yeah.
I don't mind.
I haven't played in a long time either, but I would say I can understand why. It's the same reason people would play Dominion, the original Dominion, and they wouldn't put in any attack cards, because they,
it's true,
they just wanted to maximize their engine as opposed to getting punched in the face a few times.
I don't mind if people say that they don't want to play with mandatory quests. I really don't, because Lords of Waterdeep is fun either way. And sometimes you can be in the lead, or you can do something to tick somebody off, and they keep slamming me with mandatory quests, and it's just a pain in the butt. But at the same time, it's kind of fun. So
it is. Yeah. It's part of it, right? You got to knock somebody down, but oh well.
But oh well. I don't mind that either. So we are coming up on the end here. We want to kind of start wrapping this up soon, but I just want to bring up one last point. And do any of you feel that there are any potentially harmful house rules? So I'll just start off just as an example, but there's a recent thread on BGG that was a pretty long discussion of somebody who felt like they were a little too hamstrung in New Bedford, only getting to use two workers. And they also felt that the game wasn't lasting long enough. Now, to me, I think the game is obviously balanced for two workers, and also it's balanced to do 10 rounds long, because it gives everybody a chance to kind of get their engine going, but not give them enough chance to do absolutely everything they want to do, because that's really the point of an optimization game and a worker placement game, is to try to make the most of what you have within the time that you have. So there was a huge discussion about somebody wanting to use three workers and maybe extend the round numbers to 16 rounds. Now, in my personal opinion, I didn't feel like the initial build of New Bedford was built for that, and I didn't think it would be very fun. And yes, three workers have been tried, and of course, and so on and so forth, but the game is balanced for two. But in the end, we simply said, you know what? Give it a shot. And if you like it, and it works for you, and the way that you want to play, go for it. In my personal opinion, I felt like it would probably be harmful to the game itself, but that's not really, I mean, it's not really the, I guess,
a large change.
It is a large change. Yeah.
That's like, you know, taking the main mechanic that you use in your game and going, let's just try this one instead. You know, like, yeah, a little bit weird. That would be weird, but you could totally do a lot more things if you had that.
Yeah, I agree. You totally could. And when he said, like, you know, if you want to try it, then by all means go for it, because that's a house rule. It's like, if they want to play that way with the game, they bought the game, they're enjoying the game. If they want to play that game, then go for it. You know,
Can I be my usual negative Nelly here?
Yes, sure. Absolutely.
So I'm a big fan of Dark Souls and the whole series and everything. Mm-hmm. So I put this little quote in here. One of the guys that was really excited for the game, for the Dark Souls, the board game, from Polygon, he wrote a review of the game, and it was actually negative. I mean, he had played the game before, but he had only played the boss battles, I guess. And he got to play the whole game and just didn't like it as much. Right. But this was kind of disconcerting for me as a designer to read this last sentence or paragraph. And I just kind of want to read it, because even though it's a, like, you know, even though it was a slightly negative review of the game, like, a lot of people are really enjoying it. And I thought this was interesting. So he said, because of Dark Souls following, look for a booming cottage industry of homebrew mods for this game. I can see fans ginning up boss battle only character builds that forego the entire early game entirely. But for now, if you didn't get in on the initial print run via Kickstarter, I would recommend pumping the brakes and keeping an eye on the Board Game Geek page for fan-made updates. And I was like, is that, like, should we expect, like, is that how, is that the level that,
that
we're,
the level
at
we're at
for
yeah.
games? Right? Yeah. Like, I mean, should we expect that there should be downloadable content later that will fix problems? And yeah, that was scary. I hope no one writes something like that for one of my games, but I can see that coming.
Well, I don't know.
I mean, it's true that they're going to be homebrewing it, but like, it should we be really just dependent on house rules? Is that potentially harmful? That's what I was trying to get to.
No, it's a great question, and it begs thought. And I don't have the answer for that, but you're absolutely right. We're in the age now where house rules can become, house rules and variants can become much more prevalent because of the forums on Board Game Geek, you know, Reddit, lots of more game groups out there playing these games and suggesting changes that they then pass on to someone else. Is that going to become more the norm of like, well, I don't know, should we play this way or should we play that way? And then you look on the forums and you're like, well, I don't like playing this way. Oh, there's this whole new way to play the game. Is that good or bad? I don't know. Is it harmful? I don't know.
I think me and Jessica though that's going to trigger our OCD.
Yeah, Jessica's going to be like, no, I'm not playing that way. It's not the rules.
Yeah, we're not going to play downloadable content. No new rules that we'd have to download to play this game.
Nope. I already watched a video. I already read the rules online. Nope, we're not changing it.
Exactly. Better be good up front.
That's right. The only other thing that I'll mention is fan-made content, which I don't really frown upon. It's just simply people having fun with it. Like, for instance, Bottom of the Ninth has a lot of very fervent fans that have modified certain things in the game to, like, you know, mimic real players or fantasy players or whatever, you know, and they've always been very kind of like saying, you know, we're going to do this, but of course it's not official. And we're, you know, that's fine. You want to have fun with the game, do those type of things. As long as you're not selling it and making money off the game, fine, go for it. Have fun with the system. However, the harmfulness I think you mentioned, or the potential harmfulness you mentioned with Dark Souls, is that people who are introduced to the game go on Board Game Geek and see all these kind of homebrew mods, and all of a sudden they just start testing them out without giving the game a fair shake. I think that could be harmful to the game, possibly in the long run, for word of mouth and also further reviews and making people want to buy the game. But it's tough.
It's weird. It's weird, but it's like a video game, so hey, who knows?
Downloadable
but
content.
I think house rules are great if it makes it more cool for you. I just you know, I think you should try it first, being super pure, get really angry at the game, and then fix it yourself.
Yep. Or even better than that, design your own game.
Ooh.
Or don't, because it's a crowded market. I mean, why would you want
to? Yeah. Just don't do it. Just reap the benefits of everyone else's creativity.
Lord. Yeah, exactly.
That's, and with that, and with that note, let's move on to the backside of the podcast. All right. So, pretty short note here for notable Kickstarters. TC, do your little PSA if you want to.
Brass. It's here, and it's made over $500,000, or that's what it says on there. But you know what? That's, I mean, American dollars. In Canadian dollars, it's made tons.
It's almost $1 million in Canadian dollars.
Yeah, almost $1 million in Canadian dollars. And I'm still on the bet. I mean, I think I'm going to lose this bet, because it was like $1.5 million in U.S. dollars was the kind of like over under for it. And I think I might lose. I think I might get a little under that. But but maybe not, because it's got awesome, like, now they have a stretch goal for like clay money, and they already hit it.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, I'm like, ooh, not metal money, clay chips. Oh, this is perfect for like, because I don't know if you played like train games and stuff like this, but like, that's what everybody uses.
Yeah, of course.
So do it. Ah, so good. So yeah, so I still haven't pressed the button on this one, but I don't know why I haven't.
What? Why haven't you?
It's $100. I gotta get both.
Yeah, you can't just get of course one. You can't just get one. But I mean, yeah, this is you, Rittenhaller. It's beautiful. It's brass. Why don't I mean, if you're gonna back a Kickstarter and do it for $100, I spent $100 on dogs to get Bubba's name in the game. You can buy brass for $100.
But there's no level for me to get my dog in this game.
Oh, a little Fergie and brass.
Fergie. but yeah, you should check out brass and don't be like me. I mean, if you can, I know I'm gonna do it, but I'm just like, duh. If you don't be like me, just, you know, plunk $100 down. It's around 100 in US, and I don't even know what that is in Canadian. It's probably like $7,000.
Yeah, about.
So I mean, since the dollar's strong, use it wisely.
That's right, for now. It's strong.
But
for,
yeah,
now
I'm super excited for brass. I just hope it does really well. I was watching a playthrough last night on Heavy Cardboard and it was fun.
As far as Dice Hate Me Games news, we mentioned last podcast the Viva Javas are coming. The Viva Javas are coming.
Run
to your local game store.
Right, exactly.
And pick up a copy of Viva Java or Viva Java Dice.
You totally should.
Both amazing games. You should probably get a 2-pack.
Yeah, you should get them. I mean, you should get 2 of each, right?
Yeah, 2 of each. I mean, like, if you're going to get one, you might as well get one for a friend, and then
everyone should know, I mean, warning right now, you cannot play Viva Java or Viva Java Dice unless you have both. Like, you have to have both to play one or the other. So,
well,
just putting
true.
That out there right
well, yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah, we'll just say that. Let's just go.
Well,
ahead.
Because there
and
are
And another
cards...
disclaimer, I may be full of complete BS right now.
No, you're not, because there are cards in Viva Java Dice that are used in Viva Java. So,
yeah, I just don't know why you have to have both to play them. It's such a weird thing you guys did.
Well, anyway, the Viva Javas are definitely coming. We have pre-orders up on the website. Also, a lot of your friendly local game stores will have previews for... or. Pre-orders ready for you. You can also pre-order through some online sites that we've already seen, like I think Miniature Market has pre-orders up, things like that. We've already gotten some of the mass production copies, the NPCs, sent to the warehouse in St. Louis, and those have been sent out to reviewers and distributors, so you'll be seeing some good reviews, obviously good reviews, because they're excellent games. Anyway, put that down, put a note down on your to-buy list to go check out Viva Java. Other than that, we got the PPCs, the pre-production copies of Fate of the Elder Gods that we just reviewed via Skype today, and they look fantastic. And there's only like a couple of notes for the board, but other than that, everything else is working out perfectly. All the art's looking fantastic. We're going to be moving fully into full production on that as of probably tomorrow once I sign the approval list for the NPC copy. And we're on track for July delivery.
Barring
we don't have a tsunami or a typhoon, but
sure, don't even put that out there.
I know.
Shut up.
Knock on wood for that. I shouldn't.
El Nino.
Yeah, El Nino. So, Unpub news. Daryl, do you have anything for Unpub news?
No, not right now. We have a big meeting coming up in June, and then some announcements following that. So, I guess I'm announcing future announcements.
You're announcing future announcements. Well, we do have an Unpub Mini coming up. Actually, by the time this podcast airs, it's probably going to be like the next day. But anyway, Saturday, April 29th at Atomic Empire in Durham, North Carolina, there is an Unpub Mini there. It'll be from 1 to, I believe, 8. And you can stop on by. We have a lot of great games to test out. I will be there actually demoing 2 Dice Hate Me Games properties, 1 Take the Bait and 1 Milkman. But there will be a lot of other things there to come and try out. So you should all come out. We're going to be having lots of giveaways. There are lots of great prototypes and things to test out. We want to get your feedback. It's tabletop day, so come out and what better way to celebrate than coming and playing some unpublished games?
That's right.
Yep, and I'm considering the one. I don't know the date, but the one at the end of May. Considering maybe I'll be going down to Washington D.C. for that, or at least outside of Washington D.C. And I guess there's one in Philly this weekend, too. Just keep in mind, there's the Unpub. You can check the schedule. There's Unpub Minis all the time.
Yes, you should go to unpub.net and click on events, or go to unpub.net/events, and you'll see everything that's coming up. You'll see the Philly Free School that's in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, going on. Game Designers of North Carolina at Atomic Empire, which I mentioned, and the one that TC was mentioning in mid-May is Saturday, May 13th at the Island Games in Centerville, Virginia. So that's it for this episode of the State of Games. We'll be back next time with even more great board game discussion. And of course, we love hearing from all of you. I'm not putting that. I'm not saying that. That is horrible. Why are you people?
Why?
What? What? Did you put this in here?
Yes. I'm serious.
Wow. I'm just going to keep nailing this one in.
Oh, my God. What the heck? I thought it was something that was like a holdover from previous notes. Now I got to read this again.
All right. Hold on. Let me mark this spot.
No, don't edit this.
Okay, go ahead.
Anyway.
Edit.
All right. Well, that's it for this episode of the State of Games. We'll be back next time with even more great board game discussion. And of course, we love hearing from all of you. A few weeks ago, we received an email from the infamous Michael Champion, who gave us the topic for episode 122, the one about bits and pieces, all about components. And because someone didn't edit the show notes thoroughly, we thanked him for a few subsequent episodes, too. Ha ha ha. Putting that part in because Jessica someone put that part say, in.
Someone could say that Michael championed contacting us.
Did you put your pinky up to your mouth when you said that?
I did.
All right, we'll edit this one out.
Well, we probably should. Well, in his email, he thanked us for using his topic and for making him a part of the show for these additional episodes, too. So this is why we're mentioning him again. And Michael, thank you very much for sending us the show topic. So if you all send us future show topics or new segments we can add to the show, then you could be Michael, and we'll talk about you for 80 podcasts. You can always email those ideas to thestateofgames@gmail.com or tweet them at thestateofgames. Of course, you can also go to dicehateme.com and comment on the podcast or join Guild 1903 on BoardGameGeek.com. You can also always hit me up on Twitter at dicehateme. What about the rest of you?
You can find me on Twitter at GetLouder.
I am a Puppy Shogun on Twitter, and you can check me out on the Perfect Information Podcast. I do a deep design segment. I'll also be there and, you know, learn something from me.
And I am on Twitter at FeldFangirl, and you can also find me on the Our Turn Podcast and also the What Did You Play This Week podcast, which I haven't been on for several weeks, but I should be back this week.
Slacker. Yes.
I've been traveling.
Well, until next time, this is Dice Hate Me.
This is Get Louder.
This is Puppy Shogun.
And this is Feld Fangirl.
Saying thanks for listening, and may all rolls be sixes. Wow.
Sixes. I should just cut and paste the one when we were live and just put those at the end of every episode.
Yeah, you probably should, but it's not quite as fun because everybody's listening to us see how badly we are in sync.
Mm-hmm.
Da 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 da.
You guys are all late.
I was early.
This is how we do it.
All right, so we're live.
All right.
So as soon as everybody...
Live!
This is the new intro. Hi, we're live.
Hi,
we're live.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We're alive for now.
We're alive.
We're alive at the time of this recording.
That got dark quick.
Yeah. It always does.
Coming to you from the grave.
Grave.
Ghosts.
Ghosts.
That's my favorite thing to do in a Dungeons and Dragons campaign. There's always got to be a ghost so someone can say ghost.
All right, let's do this.